And in this case, for me, it was like finding myself again 20 years into my adult life. I had followed my passion and meaning and impact, and I was completely burned out. So it was, I needed to figure something else out.
Welcome to Re-Energize.
This is a podcast about renewable energy.
Yeah, we know what you're thinking. Another duo of clean tech bros wonking out on energy policy.
Think again. This is about your energy.
How do you find peace on the emotional roller coaster of renewable development? How has this work transformed you?
We ask these questions together with people who have lived it.
Plug in.
It's time to re-energize. I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but there was some newsletter that you had sent where it said, the headline was like, manage your energy, not your time. Mm-hmm. And we had literally just, you know, maybe a couple weeks before had an interview with somebody and Joel had made that like exact comment. And I was just like, there's definitely a lot of overlap here in terms of what you're working on and the way you see the world and the way that we see the world and what we're trying to do here. So just thought it made a ton of sense to invite you to join us and really glad that you accepted.
Well, likewise. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
We're very happy to have David Rosenheim here with us today. David is the lead executive coach at David Rosenheim Executive Coaching. He's been the leader working to create positive change and better the world for more than two decades as a VC-backed tech and nonprofit CEO. Now he is a highly sought-after executive coach. Prior to launching his coaching career, David was executive director of the Climate Registry, providing the strategic direction for the registry and overseeing programs and services and staff. David also had two stints at Jambase.com, first as COO and later as CEO. So in total, David brings over 20 years of executive experience to his coaching practice. David has partnered with a variety of leaders, ranging from early stage startup founders to Fortune 100 executives in sustainability, energy, clean tech, utilities, consumer internet and mobile, legal, enterprise software, entertainment, retail, healthcare, health tech, NGO, and government sectors. So basically every sector we could possibly imagine. Leading management consultants, leadership development groups, and coaching firms also tap David to work with their clients, leveraging his proven track record as a leader, working in a variety of industries with companies at various stages of growth. David even hosted his own podcast called the Sustainability Leaders Podcast from 2018 to 2029 with a very impressive list of guests, including state legislators, policymakers, and CEOs. Definitely worth listening to some of those interviews that were done in a little bit of a different time than we're sitting in right now here in 2025. David is also a poet and a songwriter, which as a songwriter of myself is something near and dear to my heart. He lives in a solar-powered house by the sea with his wife and two boys, currently serves as co-director of Northern California chapter of E2.org, and David holds an MBA with distinction from Oxford University. David, welcome to Re-Energize. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jay and Joel. Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm trying to play the game of trying to figure out the sectors that you haven't been involved with. So, Dave, if you could do like children's toys for a brief stint, I think we'll round it out. That would be, I think that was the only one I could find that might be missing.
I have not coached Hasbro yet. I should say that with that kind of, you know, long list of sectors, more than half of my coaching is focused on renewables and clean tech.
Nice. This is perfect. Interesting. Yeah. This is great for right in line for this podcast. And that's a wonderful segue, David. So how did you get into clean tech and climate work?
I'll give you maybe the short version and I'm sure we'll unpack it. You know, as Jay mentioned, I'm a musician and the early part of my career was in music. It was first just writing and recording and touring. All through my 20s. Towards the end of my touring days, I had an idea related to the internet, and the internet was new. It was still, you know, the mid 90s. And I spent time developing this idea and launched it. And it became a business that ultimately owned and operated not just the initial website that I had launched, but more than 100 websites. We bought a bunch of websites and raised a bunch of venture capital to do this. And it was a network called musicfans.com. And we ended up raising venture capital and stuff to do this. Fast forward to the dawn of the new millennium, my first business fell apart. It had this sort of, prototypical meteoric rise and fall. And my wife and I went backpacking in Central America for several months. And that's when I first became aware of climate change. I was also doing a lot of reading at the time, and I became aware of this concept in Jewish thought called Tikkun Olam, which means to heal the world. It's the idea that the world is broken, and it's our ethical imperative to try to piece it together in our lifetime. And so the recognition of climate change and this kind of idea of Tikkun Olam, of healing the world, fused, and I really wanted to focus on climate change. And I actually went and got my MBA at a school that had a program in social entrepreneurship, and I took a lot of classes in that program, and I was hoping to focus on climate. But when I graduated and got my MBA in 2005, the renewable industry was really still in its infancy. Clean tech didn't exist. We actually tried to launch a biofuels business, and that didn't really go anywhere. And so I ended up going back into tech, and I had done some work for Jambase as sort of a part-time COO, and they hired me to be CEO. And we built the world's largest database of concert information. And I loved that work for a time. But at a certain point, after 15 years of being in the music business, I realized that my love and passion for music was not really being nourished by the industry. The music industry is not really a soul-nourishing place. And I was kind of losing my sense of meaning and purpose. So while I was at Jambase, I actually started working with a coach, Joe DiNucci. And I was doing some pro bono stuff on climate and trying to get involved. And I ended up hooking up with one of my teachers from business school, a guy named James Tanzi, who was launching a carbon offset development company. I did some work for them. And then ultimately, the Climate Registry just called me. It was like through a mutual connection, and they were looking for a new executive director. And I answered the call. And that was the end of my music tech startup days, and it was a big shift.
I remember kind of those days too, when you were probably head of the Climate Registry, and we were digging into your various protocols at Community Energy and trying to think about how we were going to, you know, get carbon offsets for our solar or wind projects and things like that. It's like a bit of a circuitous route, but there's a lot of time in there. It sounds like, you know, just continuing to stay connected to like a professor from business school and these people and kind of helping you find kind of different opportunities that are falling in your lap. But it sounds to me like, you know, you're a person who has kind of followed your heart and your gut and kind of seen opportunities come to you and known, you know, which ones to go after and which ones not. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so. I didn't have a master plan. Sometimes I had a big goal with each of the companies. You know, we definitely did a lot of work on vision setting. You know, I think I had a goal when I was in my rock and roll days. It was basically to be a rock star, you know. I would not have articulated it that way then. It had more to do with, you know, with the art, I think, itself. So sometimes I had a big goal, but I think I think I followed just like what felt alive to me, like, you know, what was in my heart. And sometimes, by the way, that came from a sense of possibility and, you know, creativity. And sometimes it just came from a place of fear, you know, like it just felt like survival. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to like kind of look back at decisions and see which was dictating the story, fear or possibility.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we invited you here. Our platform is, you know, we kind of have people tell us a story. So just if you don't mind, give us a quick summary of the story, and then we'll get more into the detail.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think about the big sort of the biggest pivot, like that, that was a big pivot for me going from music to climate. The bigger pivot came after I had been working in climate for about 7 years, 6 years of which was at the Climate Registry. And I had reached a point of really burning out after years of really great experience and great work. Took this sort of, I decided to take a sabbatical. Wasn't really a sabbatical because I wasn't getting paid, but we essentially, you know, I left my job at the Climate Registry and we took our kids out of school and we traveled for about 8 months. And I really went through, that was the beginning of a, you know, year or two where I really redefined my life and my career. And it kind of changed everything. And so that's sort of the thumbnail, and I guess we can unpack it.
That's a nice little summary teaser for us, David. So let me ask you to set the stage for us. Where were you? You kind of did a little bit already in your career at this point and your personal life at this time.
Yeah. So that, you know, I think of my career so far, maybe in three stages or three acts, right? That the first was in music and then in tech startup world. The second act was leading in climate and leading this small but influential nonprofit called the Climate Registry. And I was so excited when I landed there. You know, I felt like, okay, I have achieved meaning. Like I'm doing something that is contributing to healing the world in a meaningful way. We were doing things like every year we ran a delegation of states and businesses to the COPs, to the UN climate conferences. Mm-hmm. We hosted an annual Climate Leadership Awards conference. I had a board that was populated by senior air regulators from 35 of the US states and all of the Canadian provinces. I had never had any sort of regulatory background before. I was just in the music business. And so to have a board of these really deep policy experts was just so interesting to me. We developed at least the blueprint for something called the National Energy Efficiency Registry, which would have been a way of crediting energy efficiency projects. So we were doing this just really cool work on the federal and state level, and we had hundreds and hundreds of large corporate members. So peak experience for me at the Climate Registry was co-hosting a delegation to Paris for the signing of the Paris Agreement that included Governors Brown and Inslee and a whole bunch of business leaders.
Right.
But, you know, I think what happened for me was, as many who work on mission related stuff, I was overworked. You know, I was traveling like crazy. I was toggling between, I live near San Francisco, the Climate Registry is headquartered in LA. So I was down there almost every week. I was in DC all the time. I was going internationally to all these places. And I felt like I was watching my boys grow up in warp speed, you know, from a plane or from these different places. And I was really starting to just experienced a lot of anxiety, you know, candidly, like I had to, you know, go on medication and I was feeling less and less in control. And my wife and I made this kind of life-changing decision just to stop. It was early in Trump won and I talked with my board and gave them my resignation with a long off-ramp, like a 6-month off-ramp. And we decided to take the boys out of school and we went on this 8-month journey to 14 countries. And as happens, I think, when you are deep in travel, you kind of reconnect with yourself. And in this case, for me, it was like finding myself again 20 years into my adult life or 25 years into my adult life. And, you know, I had followed my passion and meaning and impact, and I was completely burned out. So it was, I needed to figure something else out at that point.
And David, how old were your kids at the time?
We took them out when they were 5th and 7th grade. So they were like 10 and 12.
I think it's helpful for me, certainly as somebody who's had kids. Joel's got younger kids and, you know, obviously a lot of people out there do. You know, it's just a different stage of life when your kids are, you know, 1, 2, and 3 than when they're you know, 14, 15, 16,
yeah.
18 is my oldest now going off to college. So
yeah, I got one of those too.
Yeah.
And how, dude, how many years had you been doing that? Like how many years at Climate Registry and before that? I mean, you layer on the other work, the music industry, like how many years at this point in time did you feel like you were kind of running, sprinting on the work front?
At this point, I had been either a CEO or a COO for almost 20 years, excluding the 15 months that I went to go do my MBA.
Yeah.
So it had been, yeah, exactly. It was a sprint. It was, you know, startups. And I thought maybe going to the nonprofit world would, I wasn't looking to necessarily slow down, but I thought, okay, maybe the pressure will ease a little bit from, you know, not having investors. You still, it's every bit even more intense because you still are fundraising constantly. You have investors, you have a wider set of stakeholders, and actually the interests are less singular when you're running a nonprofit. There's mission. Obviously, you still have to be in business, so the money is still important. And you have different stakeholders whose perspectives and politics you have to balance. In a startup, everyone's pretty well aligned. You want to make this thing work for shareholders.
Yeah. Yeah, there's one. Yeah, it's more one-dimensional.
Thing I want to just dig into a little bit. I'm curious. You mentioned developing a sense of anxiety at a certain point that kind of became something that sounded like was a turning point for you and saying, okay, I got to get off this roller coaster or Ferris wheel or whatever it was because of that. How did that come to develop? Like, as you look back, what was it that caused that to develop?
That caused the anxiety?
Yeah.
I think it's a combination of external and internal factors. Mm-hmm. The external factors, looking way out, we were stepping into a completely hostile political environment federally. Mm-hmm. So that required really questioning a lot of our fundamental assumptions about our business model, about the work that we were doing, about the language that we used to talk about the work that we were doing. We're in a similar phase right now. Also externally, funding, as I mentioned before, funding for a nonprofit is always tenuous. And it goes through cycles. You go through cycles where what you're doing is popular and acceptable, and it's easier to raise money. And then, you know, the screws get turned and it becomes very difficult. Mm-hmm. Yet you still have a staff who have families, and I have a family, you know, and so it's hard not to sort of internalize the financial anxiety that mm-hmm. the organization might be experiencing and conflate it with your own financial anxiety. And then that starts to, that internalization starts to affect your inside game, right? And so, you know, the relationships that you have to manage when you're in the hot seat, in the executive director or CEO seat, you're managing a staff and they have their own stresses. You're managing projects and funder relationships. You're managing a board and they're going through each of their own situations in the case of the Climate Registry in their states. And if you're working too hard, if you're kind of over-indexing on the work and trying to solve for all these problems, you lose your grounding. You lose your ability to see the forest through the trees, mm-hmm. to regulate yourself emotionally. And so it's that sort of compounding of external and internal factors. I think that for me, just brought me actually to burnout. And I didn't realize that I was burned out. I mean, I knew that I was experiencing intense anxiety, but I didn't know what burnout was until 3 months into our trip. We were actually in Africa on safari, and I kind of felt this release in my bones where I was like, oh my God, you know, I'm exhausted. I was completely exhausted. And it took me, I never figured out. It wasn't like I went on the trip and I figured out what I wanted to be. I just knew that I couldn't do the CEO thing anymore. Mm-hmm. And that I need to do something very different, not just in the work that I do, but kind of in my way of being, in the way that I was showing up in my life.
Thanks so much for sharing this, Dave. It's really powerful. I think it's something a lot of folks can relate to, whether CEO, COO, project manager, whatever the time, you know, periods of burnout of, hey, wait, this, what got me here isn't working anymore. And something I find fascinating here, listening to you talk about this, is this was 20 years in. And I don't know, we're not covering your whole 20 year career here. So for all Jay and I know, you know, you might have had other periods of renewal, you know, and changing the career. Sure. And it reminds me of something, reading this book called Transitions right now, which is really good, all about life's transitions, and literally on the chapter on career right now. So this is top of mind listening to you. And I think the quote is, I'm going to bungle the quote, but it basically says, like, it's from Goethe. And the quote is like people think of their career as like this one singular kind of continuum or thing. And maybe for some folks it is, if they're at the same place, but even for folks who maybe spend their whole life at a utility, like, guessing their careers are also reinvented every, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years. And so just this idea of reinvention is kind of just coming as a just emanating off of you. Because it's not like you just said, I'm no longer going to work. And I'm guessing you went to school again. And, you know, you hinted at that earlier. And then you're coaching again. And I'm assuming here you're very active, you know, right? And so it wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't that you just said, like, I can't work, or, you know, and fill the days with things, but yet you needed to reinvent.
That it's true. I mean, and I think you're right. It's not the shift that I was pointing to is sort of like the biggest one, but we do go through reinventions all the time. One of many great things that I learned in the year that I spent in coaching school is that there's an opportunity that we have, and to reinvention might be one way of stating it. Another way is to shift our system of interpretation, our way of understanding our lives and in our world. And biologically, that opportunity often comes in, you know, sort of like early midlife. Maybe it's actually just midlife. You know, for me, you know, I was 47 when this happened. You know, it's kind of like a midlife crisis. So sometimes it is a interruption that happens. Maybe you lose your job. Maybe you lose your relationship. Maybe it's more subtle. And again, biologically, I think that there is this kind of, you know, call it roughly sometime in your 40s, maybe into your 50s, where you do have the opportunity to kind of question what you've, the way that you've been, your way of being up until now, and say, hey, do I want to do things the same way? Do I want to do something different? And that for me showed up in this really interesting way. So at the beginning of, I think, our first week in coaching school, the panel of teachers asked each of us, hey, what do you think your possibility for the year is? What's your possibility for the year? I was like, oh, that's an interesting question. And I said something about like balance. Oh, I want to have more balance in my life. And this is something that a lot of people feel. Like they want to achieve this kind of, you know, holy grail of work-life balance. And the coaches said, okay. And the teachers kind of talked amongst themselves. And they came back and they said, your possibility is not balance. It's a year without achievement. A year without achievement. And at first I was like, that sounds amazing. Like, what a load off. I don't have to achieve anything. And then after I sat with it for, I think I just slept on it. The next day, I'm like, that's horrifying.
Terrifying. Yeah. You're like, but that's been my mode of like, that's how I've understood my days for the last 20 years. What do I do if not that? Yeah,
exactly. That was what I came back with. I'm like, how do I do that? How do I do this? And that has been my journey now, you know, that was at the beginning of 2018. That has been my journey for the last 7 years, is reorienting myself. And achievement still has a place in my life. It's not that it's bad or wrong, but I was way over indexing. And what that meant was that I was over efforting. I was trying too hard. My boys call it, I don't know if you guys have heard this, they call it like a try hard.
Oh, yeah.
Guys, try hard, right? Which I think is, that kind of pisses me off. I'm like, look, you got to make an effort.
You got to.
It's okay to try. You know, like, I don't think that should be a pejorative, but I was, you know, I think a lot about effort, and in Buddhism, there's the idea of right effort, right? And you can, so you can either have too little effort, too much effort, or just the right amount of effort. And I think our top of the bell curve in our society is way too much.
Yeah, we're way skewed. Yeah, we're way skewed. I wonder, did the quantity of effort, maybe that's part of it, but I'm wondering about this other dimension, which is unrelated to the quantum of effort, and it's just the attachment to the outcome. And I wonder, David, has that come up for you at all? Because I notice, like, whether I'm trying a little bit or trying very hard or somewhere in between, if I have a really strong attachment to the outcome, it feels like try hard for me. And I'm wondering if that resonates or not. Yeah.
Absolutely. We were getting at this when we were talking about, like, are you the life's journey and are you following some big vision or your gut? And I think goals can be really useful, or, you know, a focus on the outcome can kind of steer you in the right direction, but then you need to hold it really loosely, because otherwise it becomes this rigid thing that you're just grasping to. There's also this idea of, you know, I meditate a lot, and there's an idea when you meditate of no gaining mind. So the idea is not that you're meditating for some outcome like enlightenment. I'm going to sit until I
I'm going to enlighten
the meaning of life.
I'm going to be more enlightened. Yeah.
Right. that doesn't really work. That doesn't help your meditation.
Yeah, whoa, Dad. You try hard, Dad. Yeah, you're Dad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think the way I see it, just to repeat and maybe rearticulate, is that navigationally goals can be important in terms of, like, setting the direction, but then you've got to really just hold them loosely and have flexibility.
Yeah, I really like that. That resonates a lot with me and some things I've been working on and thinking about lately. Just wanted to get back to the story, because, you know, you described sort of your career as it came to this head here at the Climate Registry, really important work, and, you know, decided that you needed to go do something different. You did this travel for, you know, 8 months, and, you know, you felt that sort of sense of relief after a while. You kind of understood what you'd been putting yourself through. Where did you go from there?
So while we were on the road, I could not figure out what job to pursue or, like, what to do next. It just didn't have the stomach to even think about it. I was, like, allergic to it. You know, I'm not in a position where I couldn't work again. So I knew I was going to figure something out. What I did do while I was on the road was I started really thinking about my values, like, what is most important to me? And I made a lot of lists of the things that were most important to me. And then I would kind of, like, deduplicate the things that were similar and rearticulate the list. And I ended up with, I think, 5 things that were really important to me, and became sort of a litmus as I considered what to do next, what careers to do next. Meanwhile, my original coach, Joe, had been telling me for a few years that I should be a coach, that I should go into coaching. And my dad, who had been a successful entrepreneur and is my all-time business mentor, in his sort of last act career-wise, went into coaching nonprofit leaders. And Jackie, my wife, was like, Coaching's it. I didn't really feel it. I was like, well, maybe I need to do something else first. I'm not, Joe went into coaching when he was, I think, like, in his early 60s, same as my dad. Mm-hmm. I still had probably some operating years left. So at first I started coming up with this idea of launching this other business. But I was like, you know what, I'm going to go to coaching school, because it lined up with my values. Like, every single one of my stated values, I'm like, that actually works. Mm. So I just decided to, there was a program starting. It was the same program that Joe had studied at. It's called New Ventures West. And it was starting literally 3 weeks after we landed back in San Francisco. So I started that, and I was starting this business. Mm-hmm. And so that year of 2018 was sort of this year of further transformation, because when you're in coaching school, you get coached heavily. Mm. And I went through this, you know, real shift in the way that I saw myself. And ultimately it started to gel you know, that this was the career that, that I wanted.
Yeah. Just make sure I understand the timeline. So you had pangs of anxiety and a shift internally around the work at Climate Registry. I know CEO isn't right. You gave that the board a 6-month runway. Did you use that whole 6 months? Or did you stay, were you at Climate Registry the whole six
I
months?
I did, yeah.
You, so you were there the whole 6 months. Then you went on the big trip with the family, yeah. 8 months. And then a few weeks after that, when you got back, you were kind of like, okay, I'm going to go to school. You weren't, at that point, if I'm hearing you right, you weren't like dead set on coaching, but it sounds like you were serious about it if you were going to, you know, go to school for a year. But it, but at the very least here, it was really 14 months, between the moment of anxiety, you know, and sort of kind of choosing a heading for coaching. Is that right? Or how would you, yeah, a little over a year-ish. Yeah, somewhere in there, though, whether it's not 10 months or 14, you know, but you stayed in this. Something that you said that I think is really interesting is you were kind of allergic to like thinking about, you know, the vocation. You went to the values instead. And it sounds like it was a real gift to take that time and allow yourself to be in the messy sort of, I don't know what's going to come next. But what did that feel like? Was there any part of you that someone who had been sprinting for 20 years, was there any part of you that was uncomfortable? Like, I don't know what I'm doing that. Or like, what were the feelings going on like during this, you know, cause we now have the benefit of hindsight. It all seems to work out great, but what did that feel like for that year-ish long period?
So I think I deferred. I was going to say my initial reaction is it was scary as hell. It was just so frightening. And there were a lot of moments of that, but I deferred a lot of the fear while we were traveling. Cause I needed to take a break. Like my body needed to take a break from the anxiety. And I, you know, we created this bubble. We had figured out the money and all that stuff to do the travel. As I started coming back. Yeah. I mean, it was more absolutely pressure. Horrifying because, you know, because it's such a different career. I had the great model of Joe, my coach, who had been a Silicon Valley software sales executive. He'd been like a head of global sales for Silicon Graphics and stuff like that before he went into coaching. And he had a good career as a coach. You know, he was making a good living. So I was like, okay, I can just do it. Like if I decide to do this, I can, you know, I can make a living doing it. What I later learned is that, you know, the vast majority of people that go to coaching school cannot make a living coaching. Yeah.
You might be a great coach, but you got to get clients.
One thing you mentioned sort of going through coaching school is sort of this reawakening kind of who you were and what was driving you. Tell us about that, like from what to what?
Hmm. So the from what is maybe easier to answer. The to what I'm still living into right now, but I'm going to try. I would say the from what is kind of the mold that my dad had created in a lot of ways, which was the entrepreneur, the leader, the achiever. Mm-hmm. Those are what come up for me. There was a lot of people pleasing, you know, in that mode, and just a real forward moving energy. We were talking about goals before. I mean, you know, in my business world, I was very, very goal and just execution minded, you know. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned before, one of the products of that, I mean, there were a lot of really positive products of that, you know, it sort of got me to where I was going in some ways. But one of the challenges was that it just overworked. I just overdid it. And okay, so that was, you know, kind of the from what. The to what, I think, is a life where I am more focused on being than doing. Mm. Right. That's maybe, you know, maybe that's, you know, has become a little bit of a cliche, at least in kind of the circles that I run in the coaching world. But I spend my days more focused on, just being aware of myself and being aware of my connection to others. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a lot slower. Physically, my days are just completely different. They're not as jam packed. I have a ton more flexibility. Mm-hmm. And the nature of my work is obviously completely different. It's just one-on-one conversations. And if I'm doing my job right, I'm able to really regulate myself, really open up my heart and my ears and be as fully present as I can be for the client that I'm coaching, and to really hear what they're saying in ways that they can't hear what they're saying. Yeah. And so right. that I can ask questions that will give them new insights.
And one of the things I love about, as you're talking about that, is you're in a very unique kind of career path right now as a coach. You know, your job is to listen to people, to kind of hear the things that they're not hearing themselves, as you said. But when you're talking about that sort of, you know, slowing down, that kind of being with, you know, yourself, listening carefully to what people are saying, like, it's so important for all of us in the work that we do. You know, I see that whether we're, you know, developing solar projects or, you know, talking with customers, you know, being present, kind of understanding what you're bringing to the situation, the conversation, being able to listen carefully and really hear what other people are saying before you're kind of jumping to your own view of things is so important, and maybe doesn't get enough or maybe just gets short shrift in the world of so many emails, so many Teams messages, you know, everybody kind of multitasking at all moments,
trying swimming to against the tide,
get things done. Yeah. And, you know, how many times are things needing to be repeated? And, you know, so I guess the reason I wanted to highlight that is because I feel like, you know, it might be easy to listen to this and say, well, of course, that's a coach, that's his job. But actually, I think for all of us in our day-to-day roles, the kind of mode that you bring to coaching would be very beneficial for all of us to sort of understand and be able to work within ourselves to be more effective at whatever it is we're doing. Does that resonate?
100%. I mean, and this is the work of coaching, is to create the space and the tools for at least the coaching that I do. And that's, you know, focused on supporting leaders and executives and stuff, is giving them the space to slow down and then the tools to be able to, oftentimes, like, listening more effectively is, even for people that have been in senior leadership for a long time, it's still a growth edge, because leading is relationships. That's all it is. But if you're in a place where you're dysregulated and you're not able to actually feel physically what's going on in yourself, if you don't have the space or the tools to do that, then that connection to others gets compromised. And if that's compromised, then you're not effectively able to enroll people in the project at hand and to lead them forward in an effective way. So it is, I mean, it's a mirror. The better I can slow the conversation down, slow myself down, listen well, more effectively that's going to transfer to the client and enable them with new ways of seeing things and new tools with which to lead.
I love that.
Yeah, same. Yeah. I think we all can think of a time in life where we were dysregulated, whether it was a coach or a mentor or a friend, where just somehow they maybe took a deep breath. Maybe they encouraged us to do an exercise, but somehow their presence transferred it and it created that room where we could step back into ourselves. And yeah, our relationship with ourselves is so important. So we're so thankful you're providing that service, Dave. The world needs more of it. I love that question Jay asked a few minutes ago on the from what to what. And I loved your answer. And I'd be curious, like, David, do you think, and I hear you totally, you're still on the journey. There might be some days you're feeling more in being, you know, falling back into, you know, achievement or whatnot. I mean, heck, it was how many decades of pattern, right? You know, it's going to, nobody's perfect. But I'm curious, like, if you think about the before and after, you know, where you are today or the last year compared to that year leading up to the pangs of anxiety, you know, at a climate registry, what are some of the other adjectives or descriptors that you would apply to life before versus now? If you were just to do a word cloud for each, I'm curious, like, what do those word clouds look like? Yeah.
One thing that's really interesting is that I am able to experience emotion more fully and without as much latency as I used to, right? So I would still be experiencing, you know, I still experience stressful things just like I did then, and I still get stressed out, by the way. It's not like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You just know you're stressed out in the moment as opposed to being aware of it 24 hours later. Yeah.
But it flows through me and I experience it. Whereas before, maybe I would experience something that should generate stress or sadness and I didn't have the tools or the self-awareness to be able to experience it, and it would get trapped in my body, right? Yeah. So that's what I was talking before about, like the accumulation of stresses that led to burnout.
Samskara, I think is the word. It's like a literal word for this. Samskara.
Samskara is suffering, right? And we all suffer. That doesn't go away. That's part of that is kind of what defines the human condition. But it's like, are you aware of it? Can you feel it in your body as it enters your body? And like, I don't do this perfectly, but I think that now I feel more open. I feel more able to engage with whatever is happening more fully. Nice. And I think that, you know, as a father too, like this is really important stuff. You know, I went through a period, one thing that I experience in this body is periods of depression. And I went through one of these periods a few months ago. And I think in the past, I didn't really have the tools or the understanding. It would just sit within me. I wouldn't communicate it. And I made a conscious decision in this last period just to be completely transparent about it, not hide it at all. And, you know, I have 17 and 19 year old boys now. And I think it's really important that they can see that, that a man that, you know, that their father A has emotions and can experience them, but also to demystify the challenging things that we all go through.
Yeah. I can definitely relate. And, you know, I just alluded to, you know, at the top, just a lot of changes right now for my family, you know, my daughter going to college, my, you know, youngest kind of moving to a new school in middle school. And I can relate to that kind of before and after that you described. I think there was a long time where the emotion was just repressed, just wasn't recognized or acknowledged. And now, you know, I'm sort of like, wow, this is an emotional time. You know, there's just looking over at the couch on a random moment and seeing my daughter who's about to leave, sitting there reading her book and like feeling that, you know, and then acknowledging that, hey, actually, I want to spend some time with her, you know, and not just kind of ignoring it and pushing it away. And I think it's making for a better transition. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely really happy about that.
I'm right there with you. My youngest is going to Berklee College of Music in about 2 weeks. And what you said, I think, is really important is that not just pushing it away. So a big part of this is just seeing how we react to the suffering. The suffering is going to be there all day long. I mean, I don't mean to be like, life is wonderful and beautiful, but there, suffering is a fact for all of us. And it's really interesting and empowering to see what we do with that, how we react to it, watching our own reaction. Do we disengage? Do we go harder? Do we work harder? Do we, you know, go do something else? Do we eat shit that we shouldn't be eating? Do we go sit on, you know, the couch and watch Netflix? Do we, all these different, all these reactions that we all naturally have, the opportunity is to notice our reaction and not to judge it, not to try to squelch the reaction, but to be aware of it and then to be able to make a choice. Okay, do I want to react in this way or do I want to do something different?
Yeah, I can't help but bring it back to where you started, one of the places you started, David, which was on, I might bungle the pronunciation, Tikkun Olam. And it's funny, you set out, you know, on this path of achievement, Tikkun Olam, very noble meaning there. But I just can't help think about the two of you talking about the relationships with your kids. And you're not setting out with this sense of like, oh, I have to go achieve, but you're kind of responding to your body, you know, and what feels right and forming this relationship that's very intimate. And I don't know, just sitting listening to the two of you, it sounds a lot like repairing the world. So just an observation. Yeah.
Thank you for that. And I do really believe that it has, you know, it's kind of like the old adage, it does really have to start with healing ourselves and then our connection to whoever's in front of us at the, the moment. Yeah. And that's what I love about the opportunity that I have with coaching, especially people in the climate world.
Yeah.
Is that if I can help them be more compassionate with themselves and others and achieve greater impacts in the world through the work that they're doing, and also help them have more ease in their lives, then there's like real scale actually to my work.
Right.
And it does serve that purpose of healing the world.
Right. And in a time of AI, we're going to have a lot more knowledge, but maybe less wisdom. Maybe we could move slower, and maybe slower actually is faster and more meaningful. And it just feels like spot on, David. So really awesome.
Well, David, thanks so much for having this conversation with us. I've really enjoyed it. I feel like I've learned a lot and really appreciate your time.
Thank you both so much. It was a great conversation.
Thank you for joining us on Re-Energize.
If you like what you hear, if you feel your energy rising, please pass this on to your friends.
And hey, you might have a story to share. If that's the case, you can reach out to us using our email address found in our show notes.